You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's episode is sponsored by civic engagement podcast Future Hindsight, who are back with an all-new season on systemic racism in the U.S. Each week, they'll explore how the legacy of slavery still permeates our country and how we can rectify it. Tune in this week to learn the forgotten history of state-sponsored housing segregation and how those New Deal policies still impact us today. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts. Now for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Type Media Center fellow Sarah Jaffe on her new book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. Meanwhile, the reconciliation process begins, and it's starting to shape up to be a battle between Joe Manchin and Bernie Sanders on the $15 minimum wage. There's a coalition of 120 Democratic lawmakers, and they've begun calls for the CARES Act millionaire tax cut repeal. Kevin McCarthy wavering as Democrats seek to bond the Republican Party to QAnon. And it's beginning to appear that Trump's impeachment defense is going to help Democrats in that very effort. Meanwhile, Warren to introduce a wealth tax bill and bipartisan legislation introduced to reverse the 2006 law which kneecapped our post office. The pandemic, meanwhile, has become a race between vaccination distribution and virus mutation. The FTC orders Amazon to pay $61 million in stolen tips. Meanwhile, the behemoth reaches new heights in the low art of union busting. Manhattan DA may prosecute Steve Bannon for his con of Trump supporters after all. And Congressman Jamal Bowman calls on Israel to vaccinate in occupied Palestinian territories. And lastly, Joe Biden brings the hammer down on Trump's anti-union panel. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. As always, Emma Vigeland is here with me. Hi, Emma. How are you?
I'm okay. Today's not my best day, but my mood always improves just as soon as the show starts. I'm looking forward to the show.
That's the same for me. The 2.5 hours out of the day where I don't feel tired, I have some energy, I'm excited. And then the rest of the day I'm exhausted and I just want the day to be over.
Yeah. It's almost like we like what we do.
Which is ironic, considering the book that we're going to be talking about today with Sarah Jaffe. That is one of the levers that is used in our society in many respects to keep workers down, to keep wages down, to keep people exploited, et cetera, et cetera. We will talk more about that. So that was a very astute moment to bring that up. But
yes, that's true.
We've got a lot to get to today, and much of it, very substantive in terms of a process. We got the reconciliation process beginning. Joe Biden is still ostensibly listening to Republican lawmakers who are coming in. But everything that we're hearing out of the White House is we're not going to go small.
Well, not everything.
Not everything. Hearing some talk of maybe it comes in at $1.3 trillion, not $1.9 trillion. We shall see. There is clearly an attempt by some members of the administration. I mean, I think we're already seeing a nascent split in the administration. There are some who are trying to tap on the brakes or trying to push some measure of austerity. Let's remember the $1.9 trillion. Even I think it was Senator Murphy from Connecticut was like, nobody in Connecticut cares about what or knows what reconciliation is. They heard $2,000 checks. They want $2,000 checks, period. And so
The issue, though, is that is less, you know, it seems like there actually is a significant coalition in centrist Democrats who want to lower the threshold from $75,000 for these $1,400 payments to $50,000. Why? Because they've decided to negotiate against themselves.
Well, there are, and my understanding is that there's now been three who have not gone on the record who have talked about this. Now, of course, all we need is really one or two, but three gives them cover. But the fact that they're anonymous, we are still, I mean, this is all a negotiation that we're watching play out, and we're seeing the shadows of this negotiation. Joe Manchin went on television today on Morning Joe and said, if it has to be $1.9 trillion, then so be it. So he has at least given himself the space in which to accept that. He has drawn a little harder line in the sand when it comes to the $15 minimum wage. But we, again, we'll see. Bernie Sanders has amassed a lot of reports. We're waiting on the CBO to score it. In terms of how much will it affect the federal budget enough to make it qualify for reconciliation? Now, that is in some respects less of an issue because theoretically Kamala Harris could simply overrule the parliamentarian and say, yes, it does qualify. But the other question is, how much will it make the federal government to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour because of what it will do for payroll taxes and income taxes? And will that number be sufficient to offset what needs to be offset to satisfy the PAYGO law that exists, which is basically anything that we expend, we must at the end of the day be revenue neutral. We are also seeing, as I mentioned, and this got very little attention, and I think maybe we mentioned on the show once or twice in the context of the CARES Act. There was in the CARES Act, which was the first COVID relief bill passed in early, April of last year, a tax break for people earning at least $1 million per year. And it went to only about 43,000 people in the country. Over the course of the horizon of that tax break, which I believe is 10 years, repealing that would save $250 billion. And that $250 billion, ladies and gentlemen, would go towards the pay for requirement that must be satisfied in this reconciliation bill. So it'll be interesting to see if that picks up momentum. I want to get to this legislation about the post office and about the union panel, the Federal Resolution Board. Essentially, it is like a federal board that functions as mediation for when federal workers have a dispute with the federal government about the workplace. Donald Trump had crammed that full of anti-union people who were pushing rulings to hurt the public sector unions, and Joe Biden just fired all of them last night. We can talk about that. But before we get to any of that, this is just too funny.
This is the clip of the year thus
far? This is
the
clip of the year. And it's this could work the whole year. And we're only in February.
Yep, peaking early.
So everyone's familiar with the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, and he has been pushing these conspiracy theories. He's convinced that there is special information that he has, that Donald Trump was really the president of the United States. And nobody seems to realize this. And they
He's
brought him on Newsmax.
Special man.
Exactly. And they brought him on ideas. Newsmax, which was basically, if you were to go into a laboratory and develop something to some type of agent, if you will, to help conspiracies flow through the body politic, you would come up with Newsmax. I think it would be close to it. And however, they have been pushing these conspiracy theories about the Dominion of voting machines, and they are looking at legal action. So understand what's going on here. The hosts are afraid of getting sued. So much so that they don't even want to be on camera during this. And Mike Lindell does not care. This is just too precious.
So what happened with your Twitter account and the company page?
Well, first, mine was taken down because we have all the election fraud with these Dominion machines. We have 100% proof. And then when they took it down about 3 weeks ago, I put it back up. My personal,
you're talking about machines that we at Newsmax have not been able to verify any of those kinds of allegations. We just want to let people know that there's nothing substantive that we've seen. And let me read you something there. While there were some clear evidence of some cases of vote fraud and election irregularities, the election results in every state were certified, and Newsmax accepts the results as legal and final. The courts have also supported that view. So we wanted to talk to you about canceling culture, if you will. We don't want to relive.
Pause for one second. I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt in insanity, but canceling culture.
He can't even get that right. Yeah.
No, canceling culture. Well, maybe he's just on there to actually literally cancel culture.
Yeah.
But I mean. He's trying to
cancel My Pillow Lindell or Mike Pillow. What's his name?
Mike Lindell. All right, continue.
You will. We don't want to relitigate the allegations that you're making.
Or litigate it.
Because we understand where you are. So let me ask you this. Do you think that this should be temporary? Because it appears to be permanent. Could you make an argument that it is temporary?
What?
Could you make an argument that this could be a temporary banning rather than permanent?
No, I want it to be a permanent because, you know what? They did this because I'm revealing all the evidence on Friday of all the with these machines. So I'm sorry if you think it's not
Mike, can I ask our producers, can we get out of here, please? I don't want to have to keep going over this.
Hold on a second. Mike, hold on 1 second. Let's talk a little bit about just what is happening overall in terms of censorship.
Cancel out my company and myself in this country. It's cancel culture.
There you go.
I love the moment where he realized I'm going to be legally culpable for this. We were totally fine with having him on to spout his conspiracy theories until Dominion sent us a lawsuit, a threatening legal letter. And
I wonder if they even have producers now producing those shows, or they just have basically their company attorneys.
Yeah, the in-house lawyer is the executive producer of Newsmax.
Exactly.
I would just like to go to social media just to clue you guys in on the fallout here from some of the fans. So this is a just one choice tweet from Newsmax about Hunter Biden's attorney's colleague. Then this person writes, not sure who that dude is in the center, but your program just lost tens of thousands of viewers today for what you did to Mr. Pillow. Isn't your place?
I wasn't far off.
On the person you are interviewing, and then hashtag 1984, which you can't hashtag numbers, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's nothing that George Orwell, that doesn't scream Orwellian in that clip at all.
That was, I think maybe we may just play that every day of the year this year.
Sam, you should get up and walk off right now.
I'm doing that.
Yeah.
Only when Sam smells lavender.
Exactly.
All right. Or my hairspray.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Sarah Jaffe on her new book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. Meanwhile, today's program sponsored by one of our longtime sponsors, Harry's. I mentioned yesterday, have not been shaving on a regular basis during the pandemic. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, irregular. But when I do, it's with my Harry's razor. And here's the beauty about Harry's. You don't have to choose for once between quality or a fair price. Harry gives you award-winning blades at factory direct prices. And for a limited time, Harry's is offering their starter set plus a free body wash for just $3 at harrys.com/majority. I've said this many times. Harry's delivers a close, comfortable shave, and they do it. It's significantly less expensive than those razors you buy in their sort of little glass houses or whatever they build around them in the pharmacies. Harry's Germany factory is one of the select few manufacturers in the world that have mastered the technology to create a Gothic arch, which apparently is the gold standard for razor blade grinding. They stand behind the quality of their blades so much, they have 100% money back guarantee on harrys.com. For me, I love the classic handle that they have. I love the narrow shave head so it can deal with my asymmetrical nostrils. They have a great shaving lotion as well. But for me, it's the head and the handle for me. For a limited time, Harry's has an exclusive offer for listeners of my show. New customers can get a Harry starter set and a free body wash for just $3 at harrys.com/majority. That's a $16 value for $3. How would you not try this out? You get a 5-blade razor. You get that weighted handle that I like. You get the foaming shave gel, a travel cover, and a travel-size body wash. It's an incredibly great deal, but act fast. Supplies are not going to last forever. Go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your offer right now. Folks are shopping online, obviously, a lot more of these days, trying to avoid stores. I've mentioned in the past that I used to always sit down with my daughter and told her, like, if she's going to shop online, you got to search for the coupon code. And then that all got, just became a huge mess. However, now, because thanks to Honey, which is an extension that you put on your browser, you don't have to manually search for coupon codes. It does it for you automatically. It is a free browser extension. It scours the internet for promo codes, applies the best one, and drops it into your cart. Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, ranging from sites that have tech and gaming products to popular fashion brands, even food delivery. When you go to the checkout, Honey button drops down. And all you have to do is click apply coupons. Honey searches for the coupons. Takes about a second. I don't know, 2 seconds. And it finds a working coupon. It drops it and the price drops. Over 17 million members have found over $2 billion in savings just in the past, I don't know, week or two. I asked Milo what she bought. I don't understand the words I'm about to say right now, but I'll tell you what she said. She bought something at Ulta Beauty. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, that's like a makeup store.
She said, I bought this like $15 serum. I don't know what that means, a serum. And then I ended up saving like $5.
Nice. It's good for your skin, a serum. Yeah.
I don't know why she's got a literally, I text her. She said, like. She wrote like. But I decided to buy, I'm going to take the kids snowboarding locally in a February vacation when they're off from school. And instead of renting this year, I bought the kids some of their snowboard gear. I got Saul a pair of boots, saved $15, almost 20%. I can't work out what exactly it was. Yeah, close to 20%. Just without doing anything. I'll take it. Thank you. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. And it's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid and supporting this podcast. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. And lastly, like I say, people are being a little more stay at home these days. Completely understandable. And I got a great way for you to save a trip out of your house, save some time, and save some money. And that's by not having to go to the post office. You mail and you ship online at stamps.com. Stamps.com allows you to mail and ship anytime, 24/7, anywhere, right from your computer. You can send letters, you can ship packages, and you pay a whole lot less because you get discounted rates from US, from the post office and from UPS. With stamps.com, you can print US postage, official US postage, literally 24/7 at any time of the day. And you can do it for any letter, any size package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send it to. Then you just schedule a pickup or you can drop it off. Stamps.com, you get discounts up to 40% off of post office rates and up to 62% off of UPS shipping rates. Look, stop wasting time. Don't bother heading out to the post office. Go to stamps.com instead. There's no risk. And with my promo code Majority Report, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. There's no long-term commitments, no contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in Majority Report. That's stamps.com, promo code Majority Report. Stamps.com, never leave your house again. I mean, you can leave your house, but you won't have to. All right. Let's welcome to the program, or back to the program, I should say, Type Media Center fellow, author of Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited and Exhausted and Alone. Sarah Jaffe, welcome back to the show and congratulations. The book has been getting great reviews and is just a great bit of reporting. So congratulations to you.
Thank you. It's always good to see you, Sam.
It's great to see you too. Now, first off, tell me about how you went about writing the book, because the interesting part is that it's also sort of like there's an element of how the pandemic has been revelatory and sort of reframed, not necessarily reframed, but maybe provided a fresh perspective on some of the stuff that you're working already.
Yeah. Yeah. So would you believe I finished writing this book and turned it in on February 28th of 2020, which seems like both a million years ago and last week?
Yeah.
And then went home. I was in the UK at the time, flew back to the US straight into quarantine and had to sort of do all of this extra reporting in the spring and summer to actually update all of these people's stories that I sort of profile one person per style of work that's in the book. And so I had a lot of Zoom calls catching up on everybody and finding out essentially how their work had gotten worse.
Right. And let's, I think you basically follow, I don't know, would you call them protagonists, 10 protagonists, I guess. Yeah. And explore different types of work. Broadly speaking, categorize the type of work, or maybe that's the point. On some level, you can't, there seems to be two types of work on some level that are really a function of the workers themselves, but define for us, like, how you would classify these workers and the work.
Yeah, so I split the book into two parts. And of course, there's a ton of overlap and also ways that like this narrative gets into all different kinds of work. But basically, the first part of the book is on caring work, the kind of work that has its roots in the work that women have long been expected to do unpaid in the home. And then the second half is based in creative work and the narrative around, you know, you love your creative work so much that you will do many other things, including have a side hustle in order to be able to do it at all. And in each of those sections, I have sort of five, as you said, characters that I focus on that tell the story of their experience doing a kind of work, their experience organizing around that kind of work. And in between, I sort of fill in the narrative with the history of that kind of work, how it has in many cases become a much bigger part of the economy than it used to be. And then in turn, how that narrative gets disseminated through all of the different kinds of work that other people who aren't in that particular field are doing.
I want to, what I find fascinating, I think I had a vague notion of it, but it was very revelatory, was sort of like how gendered so much of this is. But before we get to that, like, would you classify, because you're talking about artists and athletes in some instances, and home care workers and teachers, how would you classify them in terms of like working class or, you know, a PMC or whatever the, you know, because on some level there's an argument in here that is there's like a flattening in some level or a reorientation or not. Is that the case?
Yeah. One of the things that I'm documenting is the way that jobs that we would have thought of as being part of what the Ehrenreichs called the professional managerial class, the PMC that you mentioned, right? Things like working in academia, that like the conditions in those places have gotten so much worse that you actually see, for instance, adjunct professors organizing within the same union that's organizing fast food workers. And that the framework of the fight for 15 has been turned by SEIU to talk about adjuncts as like the fight for like 15,000 per course that they're teaching. So like these, the way that these jobs have gotten more precarious actually means that like my conditions as a freelance journalist often remind me of my conditions when I was working in restaurants, that the sort of instability and never knowing how much money you're going to make and always feeling like you have to hustle more, 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 more in order to get by. That's actually the condition of more and more workers, even in what we would have thought of as sort of white collar jobs.
I mean, is it the precariousness? Is it the lack of control? Is it the relationship with management, for lack of a better word? Is that what is definitional in your mind of the working class?
I mean, it's all of the above of those things, right? Like when we talk about the working class, it's important to remember that like that was never about like whether you worked in a factory or not. It was about whether you controlled the conditions of your labor. The proletariat was the thing that had the people who had nothing to sell but their labor. So if you are living off of your work, as the British writer Grace Blakely says, you know, it's a question of whether you live off work or you live off wealth. And so for so many of us, and you know, the GameStop stock thing last week sort of reminded us that like, even if you think that you're going to be able to sort of play the game with what little wealth you have and somehow make yourself rich, that's really not going to work because like that game is rigged and really you're still sort of stuck with the thing that you really have to sell is your work.
Okay. So let's go back to this notion of how gendered, I mean, your main characters, your protagonists, I guess. I think it's, if I remember correctly, nine out of 10 are women.
Yep.
And there is, on some level, I mean, we'll get to more of the sort of the questions around gender, because it's fascinating that there is, you know, this concept of, the working relationship has become more, womanized on some level. Like what does that mean?
Yeah, we talk about the feminization of labor in a few different ways, right? And that is that on the one hand, the pay is lower, right? Because like historically there was this assumption that if women were going to work in a workplace, they didn't really need enough to support the family because they were probably either married to a man or living in the house of their father who was paying the real bills. And so women were sort of working for pin money and that kind of thing.
So that on the one hand has just allowed like the devaluation of women's labor, which means that like the devaluation of fields that are assumed to be women's labor, even though there are plenty of men who teach, there are plenty of men who work in retail, and men are having to do this work that is sort of historically presumed to be just done by women. And then the other part of it is this emotional investment in the job. And so in fields like, again, like teaching, like healthcare, the kind of caring work and that investment that you're supposed to have for the people that you're working to help or to take care of, that kind of emotional investment in it is an expectation that has long been made of women, but is increasingly being made of everyone.
And you talk about, oh, Sam,
no, go ahead.
Well, you also talk about the breadwinner perspective, the breadwinner model of men's work. Can you talk about how the decline in that kind of trope in society plays into what you're discussing here?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's both like the decline of the trope of the you know, what some scholars call industrial breadwinner masculinity, which like if you think about it was core to Trump's appeal, right? As he's making this appeal to this sort of old school masculinity, which is why you see like such a huge gender gap in the Trump vote. But also it's like the real decline of industrial jobs, right? That those jobs are just going away and they are either being outsourced or they're being automated. It just takes fewer workers to produce the same amount of like cars as it used to be. So with the decline of that kind of industrial work as the backbone of the economy, the thing that has filled in around the edges that is, you know, that more people are working in now is retail. It's the service sector. It's healthcare. So in a lot of places, I'm going to plug my friend Gabriel Winant's forthcoming book, The Next Shift, which documents this very explicitly in Pittsburgh, where like the steel mills used to be the biggest job. And then the steel mills close, women go into the workforce to make up the slack that their husbands are no longer making. They go into healthcare. And now the biggest employer in Pittsburgh is the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And so it's like a very literal change in who is doing the breadwinning in a lot of cases and what kind of work that is has changed along with it.
Let's talk a little bit about the sort of, I guess, category one, where, the element of love comes into this as a function of really in many respects the relationship between the worker and who they're providing services to. Let's talk about Adela. She is one whose relationship to work obviously changed fairly dramatically in the context of COVID. Tell us about her.
Yeah. So I met Adela. I went and hung out with her on a day when she was working with her clients. She takes care of family with young children. So when I met her, she was a day worker. So she would go there in the morning and go home to her own family at night. And during the pandemic, she sort of had to make a choice of either not working because you can't nanny over Zoom, or going to end up living with her employer for Monday through Friday. So she ended up staying at her employer's house for Monday through Friday. And, you know, her own kids are at home and they're slightly older, so they're better able to take care of themselves. But also, you know, she told me about worrying that her kids are not getting their schoolwork done, that if she were there, she could make sure that they were, you know, tuning into Zoom classes and all those depressing things. And the way that like that tension between the children that she is paid to care for, who she does very much like actually care for, and her own family, who she's doing this work in order to pay the bills for her actual children. But that means taking herself away from doing like the sort of day-to-day care for them in the pandemic. And that was a really tough choice for her to make.
The idea is that her desire to take care of these kids. I mean, obviously you're a nanny. You're not going to last very long with kids that you don't like. And what, you know, that's with a babysitter as well. This is one way in which in like how. And it puts her in a very precarious position. Obviously, I mean, COVID also, you know, sort of made that decision to have to be very binary,
right?
In some respects, what you do. But the idea is that this devotion to the devotion that she has for those kids also leads her to be in a, I guess, a more coercive type of relationship, even if it is one that, you know, obviously we have the pandemic is sort of sliding in there, but even if everybody seems to be very loving about the whole thing.
Right, right. And she, so I met Adela through the National Domestic Workers Alliance, of course, and she's very involved in organizing nannies in New York City. And, you know, she has a pretty good relationship with the family that she works for. She's been working for them through, I think, now on the fourth child. And so she has a pretty good relationship, but she also has all of these stories of nannies that she, you know, that she organizes with. So there was one woman who had told her this story of, like, her employers wanted her to come back to work and they wanted her to promise not to interact with anybody else outside of the household as long as she was coming back to work. And she said, okay, but will you make me the same promise? And they like threw a fit, you know, they were just like, no, you know, it's not a, a give and take relationship that they were actually willing to have. And the thing that, you know, nannies and domestic workers hear a whole lot is like, oh, it's like you're part of the family. Except like your family can't fire you, or if they do, it's a lot harder and messier and sort of societally frowned upon. And, you know, and that was, it was so interesting to me actually to hear like the same sort of part of the family language actually when I was interviewing video game programmers, which is, you know, on one level, sort of as far away from domestic work as you can get. And yet they're also being told that when they take a job at this video games company, that they have joined the family and the family provides home cooked meals and all of this stuff. And at the end of the day, they can also get fired. And in fact, sort of mass firings are kind of common at some of these companies.
The and in a large part, you know, the I think, you know, the to the extent that you, and I'm happy you don't like have the third colon or the second colon and with like, and how to get it, get your power back or whatever that is necessary on almost every book. But the, there is a theme of organizing and unionization. And part of that, I imagine, even in the context of Adela's work, if she had the ability to say like, look, there are union rules.
Yeah.
That's a much easier way to deal with your family in that respect. Like, hey, I don't want to be in a position of, you know, getting into a fight with my family. The union is providing some parameters to make sure that I'm protected and you're protected as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, it is kind of funny, right? Because people do sort of expect me at the end of this to be like, and here are the five ways we solve this. And, you know, people are sort of like, what should I do to like have work-life balance? What can you tell our readers about like work-life balance? And I was like, my God, I wish I could tell you something. I woke up this morning, had a phone call at 9:30, and I've got a virtual event at 9:30 tonight. Like, I got no work-life balance at all. But I do think, and I sort of chose every one of these workers that I profile because they had organized around their job in some way. And so I try to let them tell the story of like what they needed, what they wanted, what they demanded, and what they won in order to say like, this is actually a bigger problem. And I, you know, I wrote this book in a way to make the case that this is a political problem that we have to solve politically together. We can't just solve it by everybody sort of having to negotiate an individual relationship with our boss or, you know, in my case, the 20 odd editors that I write for on a regular basis, that it's actually got to be something that we solve by having, you know, expanded union protections and laws of things like overtime and like including people who have been historically excluded from American labor law, or, you know, the ongoing fight to try to keep gig workers out of American labor law right now, that we actually have to think about this as these are political questions that we have to solve in political ways.
And the and so your section one, where you talk about those jobs that where there's care given involved and those have been largely and certainly in the first half of the last century associated with women. And I imagine it's it goes both ways as to why those jobs were, like, you know, many of them not covered in the Social Security Act, just as for an example. Why they're just sort of broadly dismissed. And dismissed also as being like sort of working class, as you say, like, you know, they don't have a hard hat on or their, you know, their hands aren't greasy. Yeah. Let's talk about the development of this notion of like, love what you do and this whole concept of, if you love what you do, you're not going to work a day in your life. And I just remember, like, what reminded me was that I remember going for a job interview at, like, I think it was called Super Salad when I was doing comedy, and this was going to be my day job. Yep. And I got interviewed by the guy, and I said, the guy said, like, why do you want this job? And I said, well, look, I'll be honest with you. When I take a job, I work really hard at it, but I don't want a job. And I thought I was being, like, I remember at the time, like, I thought I was being earnest and honest, and I thought he would appreciate it.
Nope.
I get the job. But like that notion of, like, dude, it's Super Salad.
Exactly. No, I have a story like this that I tell all the time, that I was applying for a restaurant job, and I was, like, just out of college, and I moved to Denver, Colorado on a whim. And I'm looking around, and I'm, you know, trying to be a freelance journalist, which, and I apply for this restaurant job, and the manager sort of sits down and, like, looks me in the eye and goes, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I just wanted to go, like, not here, anywhere but here. I really hope I'm not still waiting tables in 5 years. Right. Like that idea that, like, I have to, like, perform, that I'm going to be, like, super devoted to my job, that you pay me $2.13 an hour and everything else I make is going to come from tips, and you want me to be what now? Like, you know, I'm going to show up, I'm going to do my job, and that's what you get from me. You don't, like, get my life. And it was also really interesting when I worked in service jobs. I remember, like, over and over and over again, like, I was, you know, when I was in college, when I was out of college, but looked like I could still potentially be in college, all of the customers would want to know, like, what do you really do? What do you really do? And, you know, like, there was even this awareness there that, like, I did something else. But also it was frustrating because I was like, I don't want to tell you what I really do. I don't want to tell you that I got my third rejection from an editor this morning. Like, no, let me just take your sushi order and be done with it.
Well, so where did this come from? Because on some level, when I was younger, we were still just coming out of an era where, like, people would work for IBM for 40 years.
Yeah.
And they were a company man, is what we would hear more mm-hmm. than anything else.
Right.
And the idea was about, there was this concept of loyalty, and you get your gold watch when you leave. And there was this sense of, like, we've been a part of your life. And that has all gone away, but there seems to be, like, but we're still going to keep the emotional coercive pull to that, but just not give you the defined benefit pension that you had, and the security, and the idea that you clock out exactly at 5 p.m. Like, it's weird. The yeah. trappings that came with that relationship are gone, yeah. but the relationship is supposed to be still there.
Well, and if anything, the relationship is supposed to be more intense, right? That, like, you don't get the security you might have had at IBM if you go to work at Facebook, but, like, you know, there'll be a bunch of toys in the office. Right. There is this sort of idea that, like, the work is going to be more fun now. And one of the things that I argue in this book is that, like, some of that was employers trying to incorporate workers' demands for sort of less boring and dull work, right? That sort of in the late 60s and early 70s, you see things among industrial workers, but also, you know, among sort of kids who were in universities who were supposedly going to go into white collar work. And this sort of mass rejection of that sort of what work looked like before that. And so capitalism's really good at, like, incorporating critiques back into itself, right? And so you get, you know, this sort of trade-off between, like, okay, we'll give you more interesting work, but we're going to fire you every 3 years and expect you to go find another job. And you're going to sort of have to be always networking and always moving and always branding yourself. I cite this book in my book, which is called The New Spirit of Capitalism by French scholars Luc Boltanski and Yves Chapello. And they wrote this in the 90s, like before the age of personal branding on Twitter and all of that junk. But it's still so striking how, like, so much of what they talk about as this change in the work ethic and in the expectations of workers is about sort of networking and always be selling yourself and always be ready to jump to the next opportunity and the next opportunity. And this trade of this old ethic of some sort of security that, like, you got largely by having a union contract, right? That, like, unions fought for people to have sort of steady raises
and a pension, and you would, you know, earn, you get more vacation time as you went along and things like that, the kind of benefits you got from seniority. When you undercut all the unions, you undercut all of that too.
What has changed in our culture that has changed that dynamic? I mean, is it simply that, because I really do think this is in to a large extent generational. I mean, although, like, you know, because of my job, I think more apt to sort of like contemplate personal branding and an online presence than maybe someone else in my cohort who has a more traditional job. But I feel like my daughter, who is not working, has been, you know, sort of like, she sells stuff on Depop and she knows that she wants to keep her brand up and like, I only sell cool stuff. And like, she's How got her, she? She's 15.
Yeah.
And yeah. like, yeah. And like, and she, she's, you know, her Instagram likes and this and that. I mean, she, you know, we talk about it, but I feel like she's just in complete training to be, you know, she is like her personhood is commodified. Yeah. In a way that, like, you know, obviously, you know, I'm sitting here on camera, that, but yes. she may not even do that. That's just like, seems to be par for the course.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the things that's interesting is like, it is generational in that, like, it's happening because of like a shift in the shape of capitalism. But then what happens is, like, you know, when I went to Lordstown in 2019 to cover the closure of the, you know, the sort of famous GM plant there, you have workers who are in their 40s and 50s who are now being thrown out into a totally different economy than the one that they were in when they first got the job at GM, which maybe happened when they were 19 years old, you know? And so like the fact that like that factory is gone, there is not another one down the street the way there might've been in 1966 when the Lordstown factory opened. And now you who thought that this was going to be your job for the rest of your life are now thrown out into this world where you're competing with 22-year-olds who have a personal brand on Twitter. And that, you know, that leaves people screwed in an entirely different way, right? And I do think, like, you look at sort of the ideological trappings of the neoliberal shift of, like, Reaganism and Thatcherism and, like, you know, there's no such thing as society. And all of this, you know, the sort of arguments of, like, oh, I'm always blanking on this guy's name. He died a couple of years ago, who was just like literally arguing that everything should be a market and like marriage should be a market. It starts with a G. It's like Gary something, but it's not. I always confuse him with the guy who's at the CFPB. Anyway, but they're like real arguments from this cohort of people who, you know, come into positions of real governmental power under like Reagan and the first Bush that are arguing that like literally everything should be a market. And so, you know, now we've got dating apps. And your 15-year-old daughter is branding herself on the internet. And, you know, we've gotten this thing where we all are sort of everything is a market and everything is commodified. And that means, you know, it means so many things for how we think about our relationships to the world. But one of them being that, like, work is this super important thing. And, like, you know, my Twitter has to be a representation of who I am as a professional. Because if it's not, then some editor might see that and never give me another writing gig, right? And if I don't get answers on an email from an editor somewhere, I go back and look at my Twitter and be like, oh, did I say anything that might have, you know, did I criticize this publication at some point or anything like that? Because like, we've all been convinced that like, this is how work is, but it is how work is. You know, people hire me because they like follow me on Twitter and they see my take on something. And then I get an email from somebody saying, do you want to write an article about this for us? And so, you know, it's really insidious in all these ways, like you're saying about your daughter. I just kind of want to be like, please don't.
We spend a lot of time, you know, on some level it is what it is. And it's trying to sort of like decouple, you know, your worth. And it's conceivable to me that maybe she's inoculated from this by the time she becomes an adult in a way that maybe when it was introduced to us, but that to me seems second order still. Like there is, I can't help but think about, and I mentioned this yesterday on the show and it always resonates when Greenspan testified in front of the Senate. And I can't remember what context, but he said, you know, part of our job at the Fed is to maintain a certain amount of anxiety amongst the workforce, or something to those effects.
Yeah.
And And that anxiety, like I've noticed over the past 10 years or so, the proliferation of like life hacks and efficiencies and the rise of like quant type of people, like, and, you know, even like the Tim Ferrisses of the world who are like 4-hour work week. How do I maximize my body's potential? Yeah. That like all of these things, like I need a competitive edge. Mm-hmm. Like there has been this creation. And so where does that, on one hand, you have that notion of like the worker's anxiety. And then this other thing about, which sounds almost like the, like a different directive, which is love and be passionate about your work. Yeah. Like what is, how do those interplay?
Like there's sort of a double-edged sword to the love and be passionate about your work thing though, right? Because if you are then like, you know, you love and you're passionate about and you're really excited about your job, whether it's, again, like being a journalist or being a video games programmer, and then you get fired, then the answer is always like, you just didn't love it enough. You weren't passionate enough. You didn't like devote yourself to it enough. And so it must always be your fault if you fail at it. So, you know, like the love your job is not, it's like as much a threat as anything else. It's kind of like, you better love this job, because if you don't, we'll know and you will be replaced. And there will be 20 other, again, like young people coming out of college who would kill to have your job. So you better smile and you better behave and you better not threaten to organize, right? You better stop talking to your coworkers off the clock, if we are ever off the clock, if there is even a clock.
Is the idea on some level that it functions as like, it's not just that you should love your job, but that your job is lovable.
Right.
And if you don't appreciate that the job is lovable, there's, I mean, that's
somebody else.
That's why your compensation's so low, because your job is lovable.
Right. Right. Exactly. And we sort of, you know, there's the ongoing joke about like writing for exposure. People are like, I can't eat exposure, y'all. Like, you know, this idea, and like how many workers have I talked to who are like, you know, Uber drivers or doing some other gig economy work, but like their real daytime job is like they're a film editor. And they're driving for Uber because being a film editor doesn't actually pay you enough to live, even though, hi, how much money is sloshing around Hollywood? But people who are trying to work their way in to hopefully someday be paid a full-time salary to be a film editor are, you know, they're delivering your dinner on the side, because the hope is that someday you get to do the lovable work. Or this was me when I was waiting tables, or you when you were applying for the job at Super Salad while doing comedy, right? Like, we're hoping to get to the point where that's our full-time job and we don't have to do anything else.
Is there, does there need to be a reorientation on how people perceive workers in these different sort of categories on some level to, do we need that type of cohesion, or is that, I mean, I just like there's, I'm just curious about that aspect of it. And there's one other thing that sort of like strikes me where they come in conflict, right? Because like for the creative class, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term,
right?
The people who are supposed to love their jobs, ostensibly a big cohort of that are college graduates.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of people who have college debt who didn't graduate college. And mm-hmm. and in fact, that's where a lot of the debt accumulates, because they supposedly don't get the, but we are pushing on behalf of like a sort of a more worker oriented political movement.
Yeah.
We forefront college debt, which I am totally in favor of getting rid of. But at the same time, we don't forefront something, let's say, like universal childcare or universal pre-K or preschool, which I mean, I don't know the statistics on this, but I got to imagine when you're talking about the working class, that issue, like, what do we do with our kids? How do we get good childcare for them, particularly when they're young?
Yeah.
Has got to be as a huge, issue for working class people.
So much of these conversations, right, are based in ideas that the working class is sort of one thing, right? And that the working class, that assumption is usually like, oh, it's a white guy who works in a factory, right? And that's actually they're still part of the working class, right? There are still factories and there are still white men who work in them. There are also black women who work in them, right? There are also like all sorts of people who work in factories. There are a lot of immigrant workers in factories in America, as well as the workers all over the world who, you know, work in factories. And so like, that's the one way we sort of misapprehend it. On the other hand, you know, I think of the story that like Anne Marie Reinhart, who's a retail worker that I profile in the book, who was worked at Toys R Us, and she started working there as a seasonal hire on the holidays when she had just had her first child. And so she had left the job that she had before, which was an office job. And she ended up staying at Toys R Us for something like 30 years. And then finally, when Toys R Us goes bankrupt, she and a whole bunch of other workers are like, wait a minute, I gave my life to this company. And she, you know, she had a degree. She was, you know, has a story that I retell in the book of somebody coming up to her and saying, like, saying to her kid in front of her, right, this is why you get an education, so you don't end up like her. And Anne Marie's like, excuse me, I have a degree. Half of my, you know, part-timers are college students right now. That like, this is, there's not as clear a line as we might like to think. And we often use sort of college education as like a proxy for class in this country because we don't gather better national statistics, really. But, you know, the way that we have to understand the working class, again, is people who have nothing to sell but our labor. And in some cases, that means that you have nothing to sell but your labor. And in addition to paying the rent, you have to pay $500 in student loans with your job at Starbucks because you couldn't actually get a job. Or you are trying to be that comedian, that film editor, that journalist. And so you have a three side hustles. I'm still getting over the fact that Dolly Parton re-recorded 9 to 5 as 5 to 9, and I want to bash my head against a wall. But like, it is kind of telling of the reality, right? That she wrote 9 to 5 in the 80s when that movie, which is wonderful and everybody should watch, and is actually based in the story of 9 to 5, which was a women clerical workers organizing drive. You know, she wrote that in the 80s when 9 to 5 jobs were still more prevalent. And now it feels like everybody's also got the 5 to 9 gig.
Right.
So, yeah. So I think that we have to understand the working class as always a thing that is in a process of being composed. So we're understanding the working class as made up of retail workers and Uber drivers and computer programmers and journalists and precarious academics, right? And all of these different people actually have a lot more in common than we think. And things like childcare would be really helpful for a lot of people. And, but so would a $15 an hour minimum wage. So would student debt forgiveness. There are so many things that like we could talk about if we understand that like maybe not any of those policies are going to hit every single person in the working class, right? A $15 minimum wage isn't going to affect everyone. Childcare is only going to affect people who have children or who work in childcare. You know, debt forgiveness is only going to affect people who have college debt. But that said, like, we have to actually understand this thing as a big whole that is made up of a bunch of people who have a bunch of different problems. So what are the things that everybody needs? I mean, everybody needs a home. Everybody could use some time off. A lot of us could use a lot more time off. I do think it's important to find the policies and the demands that are, you know, appeal to the broadest sector possible. But it's also important to not forget these things because like not everyone has a child, so therefore childcare isn't a working class demand, or not everyone has student debt, therefore student debt isn't a working class demand. The people who have student debt are drowning in it and are often doing multiple jobs just to pay for it.
All right. So let me ask you one last question. That's probably, you probably need to be quicker on it than it probably deserves. But like so many of these jobs that you're talking about, there's an atomization and maybe it's heightened too because of COVID, right?
Yes.
And so the challenge is, and I think you just, you know, provided a good answer from a policy perspective, which is like, rather than one thing that's going to encompass everybody, there's going to be, you're going to have like almost like a quilt and a patchwork, to cover folks. But the commitment to do all those things is you know, everybody subscribes to all those things, right, is the way that everybody gets the thing that they need the most.
Yeah.
How do unions deal with that atomization?
The answer has mostly been badly. But like, yeah, I think that's a real problem, is that one of the things that we see is that, like, unions are still stuck in an idea of the working class and of work that is often not the reality. And the unions that are dealing best with the idea that it is going to be a patchwork of demands have been, like, teachers' unions, right? That, like, the Chicago teachers who right now are fighting about being forced back into school buildings with COVID still raging. But they have put forward a whole bunch of demands that include things like housing for their homeless students, right? And they include things like a racially equitable school system and, like, ethnic studies as part of the curriculum so that we're teaching students about more than just sort of what white America did. Right. That they put forward demands about, like, recess for kids and, like, having a nurse in the building. And they understand things like bilingual education that are necessary, not because it affects every single one of their students equally, but actually because there are students, there are people in the community who need these things. And that if everybody in the community has what they need, the schools will be better. And that means the working conditions for teachers will be better.
Sarah Jaffe, the book is Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. I think you know that. You wrote the book. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break, and then Emma and I will be back to wrap this up. Fascinating book. And I think there's I think that concept of both, you know, thinking about both from a unionization standpoint, which is, you know, what the teachers are practicing is, I think they refer to as social justice unionism, as opposed to managerial unionism, where the union is fighting for issues in the community. And by strengthening everyone, everyone gets strengthened. I mean, but I guess that's the approach. And from a policy standpoint, that also makes sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's solidarity, when it comes to workers. And I really appreciated her perspective on it too, just from the feminization of work. That was the thing that's stuck out to me so much, is that, I would have loved to ask her, or maybe I will in another time, how those cultural shifts maybe increase the anxiety in some of the political dynamics that we're seeing with the rise of Trumpism, et cetera.
Yeah. And now it's also so hard to divorce. It's been a year now that we've been basically in more or less lockdown, and it's hard to sort of disaggregate some of the sort of pandemic anxiety, insanity, and just the sort of normal insanity that we have in the context of our politics, and where that, how that is bred by the anxiety that people have in the workforce. I mean, you could just see it in the numbers. Folks your age are just at different age levels, 20, 26, 30, 35, 40, they simply don't have the money that folks in my generation when we were that age and in the boomers generation when they were that age have, not by a long shot. All right. Well, that's it for us today. We will be back tomorrow. If you missed any part of this show, check it out on the Choice channel on the Peacock app. We'll be running at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. As always, for Emma and I, we'll see you tomorrow. And for those of you who are seeing now, we're going to see you today. And Jamie's going to join us back from her being snowed in. But before we talk about that, let me just remind you. Let me just remind you that you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. When you become a member, you not only support the free show, you get it free of commercials, and then we give you extra content. So check it out. Don't forget also AM Quickie every morning, 7 minutes, headline news from a left perspective. And you can get that for free wherever you get your podcasts, or you can sign up at AM Quickie, or you can get it on the Majority app at majorityapp.com, all free, of course, and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coffee is not free, but if you use the coupon code Majority, you get 10% off, and you can also buy the Majority Report blend. Don't forget to check out Nomi's show today. Today on the Nomiki show, I don't know who it is. But,
good job, though. Good job.
Did I say it right?
You did it, yeah.
Now I'm not going to get it right because you pointed it out to me.
I'm Twitch. Sorry.
TV, the underscore Nomiki underscore show. So check that out. Jamie, what is happening on the Antifada?
Hey, so this week on the Antifada, Sean has on political economist Jason Smith to talk about the economy. What is the source of America's morbid symptoms the last 12 to 40 years? How are these tech companies and all these examples of fictitious capital so seemingly profitable when the real economy is so depressed? What does that mean for leftist politics in the capitalist core? What's the deal with service work? And what is the future of work? It's sort of a continuation of our episode with Aaron Bonanov. Everyone should check that out, patreon.com/theantifada. We also have a bonus coming out on Friday where they address the GameStop thing. And tonight on twitch.tv/theantifada, we will be doing our weekly full crew show. It's called Forever's Gonna Start Tonight. And we're having on Kenzo Shibata this week to talk about what's going on with the teachers in Chicago. Are they gonna strike? Are they getting forced to go back to work by the mayor? There's a lot going on there. So check that out. 7 p.m. ET, twitch.tv/theantifada.
He's a big organizer, Kenzo. Matt, what is happening in the Matt Lekian media universe, aside from the fact that you got a big new TV?
Well, I didn't get a big new TV. They brought the wrong model, so they had to send it back to the warehouse. So now I might
oh my God.
For the Super Bowl. So I'm a little bit upset, but besides
Wait. They're not going to get it back to you before Sunday?
It has to get back to the warehouse, and then that's the process. Then I have to schedule a new delivery. So, yeah.
Dude.
Do you still have your old one at least?
I do, yeah. But
all right. You know, well, you'll be all right.
1080p? You kidding? Anyway, yeah, I'm kind of flustered now. I forgot what I'm supposed to plug. Tonight on the Left Reckoning Patreon, for Patreons of Left Reckoning, a conversation I had with Ronald Reagan, Stephen Robbins, at Yakima Abogado, about how Joe Biden is, needs to get his ass, get his stuff together on immigration. Sorry, I'm flustered.
He's so upset about the TV.
I really am. So that's just for, patrons of Left Reckoning. We also talk about if he's aware of all these lawyers that are cashing in on YouTube now, but like the lawyer perspective on Justice Smollett and stuff like that. It's a big business. Your lawyer associates should get in on that, Sam. But patreon.com/leftreckoning tonight to hear that conversation.
What do you mean my lawyer associates?
Well, like all the lawyers, you know, that you work with on Ring of Fire and stuff, like they're missing an opportunity on YouTube by saying, here's what a lawyer says about this pop culture topic. And it just does massive clicks.
I don't even understand what that is.
But like, here's a lawyer's perspective on the Jussie Smollett case, for instance. That'll do like 100,000 to 200,000 clicks.
Okay, so it's all on legal cases. It's not like here's what a lawyer thinks about, you know, whatever that
that's basically
Matt and Angelina
what it is,
broke up or something.
I think it's basically what that is. They could, I mean, it has to be more on that stuff. Yeah, where there's, but yeah,
there's
or here's
a legal angle to it.
Here's a lawyer on GameStop, for instance, right?
Right. Okay. Weird. Yeah. It's also fun to watch Matt get flustered. For like the first time, I feel like ever. Like Matt never gets flustered, but now we know what his Achilles heel is.
Yes, it's the TV. But I mean, I'd be pissed off too. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm frustrated. But anyway,
late breaking on Nomi's show, Corbin Trent will be on. He has, what is the name of that pack that they're running? We played an ad, I think, the other day from them, going after recalcitrant senators on this whole package, if I'm not mistaken. And he was original spokesperson, I think. I don't know if original for AOC and for Justice Dems. So check that out. That will be interesting. Quick break, then fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank. Hell of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black. Black, 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 black.
See Donald Trump out there. Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock us.
Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are back. Black, black.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy.